Well, afternoon, everybody. Last year I gave a talk at LCA, and it was all about some really nice things I did to NFS, and it was all very deep and technical and kernely. This isn't. This is something that sysadmins need to know, people actually deploying stuff in the field. So if you're at the wrong talk, this would be a great time to leave. Here's an overview of my talk. I'm going to gabber on for a little bit about who I am first. Then I'm going to tell you how NFS works, because the entire remainder of the talk will be a complete and utter mystery unless I tell you something about how NFS works. Then from that we can derive the obvious performance limiting factors for NFS, and gee, there's a lot of them. And then my top 10 rules for tuning clients, my top 10 rules for tuning servers, and then most likely stuff I won't ever get to, bonus topics and some useful advice for good technique in doing measurement. So I work for SGI. We used to make cool stuff. We still do. It's just different cool stuff that people haven't heard of. There's a list of the cool stuff we make. One at the end is Nexus, which is a line of mid to high-end NAS and SAN servers. That's what I work on. File Serving Technologies is the group here in Melbourne that make all the software that makes Nexus run. Well, most of the software that makes Nexus run. We have a number of teams. The one in bold is the NFS Samba and iSCSI team, that's where I am. So about this talk. A significant part of my job is answering questions on NFS performance. When I say questions, I mean answering questions. And the question is always, NFS is too slow, what can I do to speed it up? So I have a number of years of answers for many, many iterations of this question with many different answers. And the point here is to distill all that into one enormous set of slides that I won't be able to go through in the time. It's mostly relevant to Linux NFS clients and servers, because this is a Linux conference, but there is some of those things you can take back slightly more generically. And it's mostly considering bulk read and write workloads, because NFS's metadata performance, if you went to see Zach Brown's talk, you know by now that NFS is irretrievably busted for metadata performance. There is little you can do without changing the protocol. Mythbusters. I hear a lot of this from salespeople and support people. Customer says performance doesn't matter. This is almost never true. The usual translation is, there is a performance requirement, there is a minimum performance below which I am extremely unhappy and will send your equipment back, but I'm going to make you guess what it is, because I don't know it myself. So the point of this is, performance tuning will matter, even if you think it doesn't matter. Back to contents. How NFS works. Ooh, pretty pictures. Don't expect pretty pictures all through the talk, it gets very texty later. So here we see how NFS works, or at least how most of you probably think NFS works. Here's something really important, which is a user space application that you're running. And here's something really important, which is your data, which is separated by an enormous amount of vague magic that is never fast enough. Here's my view. As you can see, there's a little bit of extra complexity. Now, I usually get asked, Greg, this green bit's slow, what do I do? Well, which bit is slow? So there's usually an entertaining discovery process where we try to narrow down which one of these billion subsystems is actually at fault. And I should point out, by the way, that the bits that I actually work on is this one, and this one, and not this one, or 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 this one. So for all of those, I'm a consumer of all of those. I'm a consumer who's had a lot of unpleasant experience with them. But there's entirely possible that for most of those, there are experts at this conference who know more about them than I. So if you hear heckles, that's why. Now, here's how the read path works in NFS. Points to take away from this. There is a page cache in the client. There is a page cache in the server. There is caching here in the hardware, in the disks. There is parallelism here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and here. So the read path from your application to the disk consists of a large number of more or less independent pipelines, each of which have their own separate transaction size and parallelism parameters that you may or may not be able to control properly. This is a fundamental reason why NFS tuning is difficult. Here's the write path. This is more or less exactly the same, except it's completely different. Over here, what happens is you get to do a lot more writes before the VM wakes up and actually sends something on the wire. That's the real main difference. But again, you've got multiple pipelines all independently tuned, and of course tuned differently from the read path. Now that I've frightened you sufficiently, we should get into the performance limiting factors. Yo. Lights. I can try the one I wasn't told not to use. Ooh. Do you want to see the pictures again? Okay. Performance limiting factors. These are the things that you can basically look at that previous diagram and work out for yourself. Server workload. This is one of the things that ought to be obvious. If you mix NFS serving and some other demand on the server, it's going to slow down both of them. NFS isn't free. It doesn't happen magically. I mean, yes, it happens in the kernel, but the NFS server, which is a kernel application, is an application, not a kernel feature, and it really wants to use all the machine's resources and the benefits if it uses all the machine's resources. My particular favorite saying is, we are the NFS server, all your cache lines belong to us. Network performance. Obviously, you can't go faster than the network, at least for bulk read and writes. For other things, you could do interesting things. So you need to make sure that your network works. You don't want a network. So your network hardware and your network software, and there's a lot of these things. Server file system performance, again, you're unlikely to do much better than your server file system in the long run. In the short term, you can use things like caching to hide that. But in the long run, and especially with NFS in its default modes, you are very much dependent on what the actual spinning Rust in the back end is doing. And again, there's an enormous amount of hardware and software involved in here that I'll skip over. My personal favorite field, NFS server versus server file system interactions. It's because the NFS server is a very strange application. It does things that the file systems don't actually see as workloads from most local workloads. There's an enormous list of them here, but this one at the top, this is the equivalent of doing an open call and a closed call around your read and write. So open, read a few K, close. Open, read a few K, close. That makes life really, really difficult. Oh yeah, looking up files by INO number. That turns out to be really evil too. So quite often your file system can't cope with these. Worse, you don't know that your file system can't cope with these. Even worse, the people who write the file system don't know that their file system can't cope with these, because a lot of these people will not actually test in combination with NFS. They'll do some really clever optimization in their file system that makes whatever it is their local workload go that much faster. Then NFS is half the speed and we don't notice for 3 months. This has happened at least 3 times in the last 12 months for me. NFS server behavior. You have other clients using the same files, you have other clients making demands on the server's resources, and you have the rather entertaining issue of the server having to sometimes respond to the client's order to get stuff onto the spinning Rust right now, please. And all of these things can have a nasty effect on performance for other clients. Then you have your typical application efficiency issues. So threading, data structures, lock retention, all the stuff that you have when you have a real multi-thread application, which is also doing network and is also doing disk. NFS client behavior. Parallelism on the wire for performance. That has a lot of interesting implications on the server. For example, your streaming write can turn into an almost but not quite streaming write, which has interesting implications. You can end up, for example, with wildly fragmented files on the server because you're getting slight misorderings of I/O and the block allocator and the file system isn't quite keeping up. You can also manage to defeat the VFS read ahead that occurs on the server simply by having slightly misordered reads on the wire due to just bad luck. And the, not read ahead too, but the old read ahead is very sensitive to that. If you do a slightly misordered read, it basically decides you're doing a random read and then it's goodbye read ahead. Your transfer size, the size of the IOs that go across the wire is limited by what the client can do. So you need a modern client to get a large number, and a large number is important to get good performance. The Linux clients don't align IOs for any kind of useful thing. So if you're writing a gigabyte, you can be writing, for example, 1 meg block sizes, which are aligned to 4K. And that's really handy for the network side, but the disks hate that. You can end up with all kinds of nasty stuff happening at the disk side. And of course, you can also have the common case, or at least the case for me, because other machines I work on are Altixes at the 16K page size, that the server's page size is larger than the client's. And then you get a number of other interesting effects. Reads. The client does its own read ahead. Hopefully this is helped by the other two lots of read ahead that can be happening and not interact with them in nasty ways. Clients, this is my personal peeve with the NFS protocol design. The client has a lot of control over when data hits the disk on the server. Unfortunately, they don't know enough to make that decision usefully. And so clients do all kinds of dumb things like saying, oh, I've written a megabyte, it's time to flush that to disk right now, please. Well, if you've got a little toy server, that kind of makes sense. If you've got a big whacking server, you've just written a small fraction of a stripe to your disk. And that's really bad. Application behavior. Applications do a lot of weird things. There's a lot of ways of doing I/O. The sizes you're doing applications, whether you're doing normal buffered I/O or using direct I/O, my God, have mercy on your soul, or OSYNC or the async I/O, whichever one of the two ones you're using. When you call fsync, if you call fsync, whether you're using mmap or sendfile or read-writes, whether you have multiple threads doing this and whether they're synchronized. Some applications try to be very clever and do buffering and caching and read ahead in user space. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes not. And of course, all of this comes down to a number of factors, but you get burstiness and correlation that can actually slow things down. So that's your performance limiting factors. How do we mitigate them? Top 10 rules for tuning clients. Number one, first, tune your network. Don't come to me complaining that your NFS is slow when you don't know how fast your network is. Because the word slow has no meaning then. So what you need to do is to work out how fast your network is. I have some slides later detailing how to do these things in excruciating detail that I may get to. You also need to think about network bottlenecks. If you, for example, have a hierarchy of Ethernet switches and the one in the middle of your three switches has a tenth of the bandwidth on the interlink, then that's going to affect you. So you need to think about the path bandwidth between your machine, that's the server, and the other machine, that's a client. Use NFS v3. v3 shall be the number of your version. 5 is right out. Don't use v2. I have some slides about that if anyone wants to know why. V4, I have a very low opinion of v4, but it mostly works. On modern clients, you get v3 by default. Use TCP, do not use UDP under any circumstances. I don't care what anybody else tells you. If I see you using UDP, that is the first thing I'll tell you to stop doing. UDP is bad, bad, evil, bad. As in data corruption bad, as in invisible data corruption bad, as in don't go there. On modern Linux clients, you get TCP by default. use the largest transfer size you can get away with, which means the largest to both the client and the server support. And on modern Linux clients, the clients will negotiate the largest between the server and the client. Larger is pretty much always better. It is in fact true that there is a size that you can get that is too large, but in fact what usually happens is that the clients or the server don't support sizes that large anyway. So you can normally squeeze a mebibyte out of modern clients and servers. Hello, yes? Would it be a case of diminishing returns? Yes, you do get a case of diminishing returns. Absolutely. On the other hand, it's usually beyond, well, the hardware I deal with, it's well above the 1 megabyte region. So for instance, IRIX servers will support 4 megabytes. And somewhere between 1 and 4, you get a point at which it's just not worth it anymore. But what you're doing is you're firstly amortizing the overhead of the call over much more data. And the call takes time, you know, server CPU resources and all kinds of other stuff. You're helping the VFS to know that you're doing large IOs, on the server VFS to know you're doing large IOs. And if you organize things right, you can do things like full stripe writes on the RAID hardware, which will make the RAID hardware go significantly faster. So there is a point at which you're going to lose performance or just plateau, but you're unlikely to reach it with the current limits of the server and the client. There are various sizes which are effectively minima, sizes below which really bad and unpleasant things happen. Examples, the client's page size, 4K, the server's page size, 4K or 8K or 16K or whatever, the server's RAID stripe width, which is usually considerably larger than either of those terms. I have seen advice. I've seen advice which says you should use a 1K transfer size because then all your calls fit into a Ethernet MTU. While that is technically true, it is probably the worst possible way of doing things. It is really grotesquely, stupidly bad because you will screw up the disk much worse than you will get any benefit out of working the network better.
Do you get much benefit out of jumbo frames?
Yes, you get much benefit out of jumbo frames. That would be that slide. I'll get to that in a moment. Okay. Don't use the soft option. On modern Linux clients, you get hard by default. In fact, I think this has always been a historical default on all NFSs. The explanation of why you should not use the soft option is quite long and complicated, and it is possible to bend the rule if you know what you're doing. If you're here listening to me to get advice, you don't know what you're doing, don't bend this rule. Use inter. This lets you interrupt your program sometimes when the server isn't there or other interesting things happen. You should use inter because it gives you the best chance of recovering from server or network problems. And of course, by the time you discover that you have one of these problems, it is of course too late to add inter. So make sure you do that. And of course, the failure, the punishment for failing to notice that you needed to use inter is rebooting your client machines every time the server has a hiccup. So this is not the default. Use the maximum MTU. Practically, this usually means 9K. You need to consult your switch documentation and experiment. Quite often, switches don't support it anywhere near as well as they say they do. You need to make sure that you have all the bits in the path between your server and the client all agreeing on what an MTU is, because the path MTU discovery that TCP does will, you know, end you losing up stuff. And you can get all sorts of interesting bugs, like I've seen a driver bug where 1500 MTUs worked but 9K didn't. So 9K, means experimentation. And a lot of people don't even go here simply because they're running through a switch they don't own, and the people who do own it, the IS group, the Change Prevention Group, don't want to go fiddling with it. And in this case, you have to agree, this is actually a kind of semi-interesting thing. What it does do is significantly reduce the amount of CPU time you need to do to get each byte of data through. And if you have really fast networks, anything but the latest 10 gig E cards, for instance, so the first generation of 10 gig E cards, had a significant difference on TCP throughput between standard frames and 9K frames, simply because they had all the interrupts going to a CPU, and they would max out that CPU and interrupt. Oh, and that's what I just said. No more mount options. Hear that laughing boy? No more mount options. You really, really don't want some mount options. I've seen people add these. Sync is my personal favourite. I have a slide later about how sync is such a good idea, not. Some really bad things happen if you specify sync on the client mount. Oh, and sync on the client mount and sync on the server export are completely different. Well, that's not true. They have the same name. Whoever named the sync export option really should have considered a little bit harder, because it confuses a lot of people. It confuses people who ought to know better, and it confuses the living bejesus out of people who don't need to know any better. I will talk about that a little bit later. Oh, NOAC. Here's a little interesting thing. This is kind of semi-documented at best. The option that turns off some caching features that are useful for metadata also gives you sync, which, as I may have mentioned, is not a good thing. Parallelism. It's rare that you need to tune this, but on some OSs you may need to. There's usually a tunable that controls the amount of separate IOs that go out on the wire at the same time. On Linux, the default is 16. That's actually a good number. That's rather more than you need. Yeah. So when I first wrote this, I could only think of 9 rules, but top 9 rules doesn't sound even slightly cool. Then I thought of one. So Linux clients do client-side read-ahead. That's controlled. The VFS read-ahead mechanism is controlled by a parameter that is on NFS, is an NFS feature. For local file systems, it's a block device feature. And it happens, the mathematics of the read-ahead algorithm is that if it's a multiple of 4, then you get aligned IOs being emitted by the client. Guess what the default value is? No, it's even worse. It's 3 modulo 4, which guarantees that if you do read ahead on streaming reads from a Linux client, you will go misaligned, then you'll get slightly more misaligned, and a little bit more misaligned, and then stay that misaligned forever. So you need to tune that. If you have a SLES machine, there is a lovely little proc interface to do that for you. Proc sys interface. That's a syscontrol. You can add it to syscontrol.conf. If you have some other things, I'm not familiar with all the distro kernels, but you probably, and certainly if you are using a kernel.org tree, you need to change that default hash define in that .c file. I have a patch that I'll be sending up soon to do that. Now, a word about defaults. You may have noticed that most of the defaults are actually quite good today. It was historically the case that a lot of the defaults were historical. So the lesson you should take from this is that most of the mount options that you can fiddle with will just make things worse. So don't go copying sets of NFS mount options that you see on the web, or you find in Google, or is in your FS tab, or from 5 years ago, or is, in that case, like one of our organisations within SGI, they have 15-year-old auto mount files. So you should start with read-write inter, or read-only inter if you prefer, and only fiddle from there if you actually have a good reason to. Mount options, trust, verify. The stuff you get in etc.fs tab is, shall we say, it's a guide. Because a lot of these things need to be negotiated with a server. So the end result is that you can't believe what's in mtab, you can't believe what's in fstab. What you need, you can't believe what mount will tell you under some circumstances. You need to look in proc mounts. There is an nfsstat minus m in recent versions of NFS utils that will also look in proc mounts for you. So quite often you will, for instance, attempt to set a certain RW size and discover that you ended up with a smaller one, usually because the server is some cruddy old piece of stuff. Enough clients. Let's talk about servers. I work on servers, so this section is far more verbose. Number one, tune the storage hardware. The parameter that will determine a lot of other things later is the hardware RAID stripe unit and the number of disks in the RAID set. You multiply those two together and you get the stripe width. So the trick here is that you want to encourage and enable it to be easy for NFS to do full stripe writes. That means if you have four disks in your RAID set, you write enough data to enable the controller to write across all of those disks at once without having to read most of them to recalculate parity for the subset that you just attempted to write. So you can double the write speed or more. So the formula is that horrible thing. Usually there will be a block level limit that may be involved, so you need to juggle two or three things here to make sure that the actual IOs going to the actual disk are the size that you think they are. And you also get the entertaining factor that some RAID hardware, like the stuff we sell, prefers 2 to the N RAID sets and won't do full stripe writes unless you have a 2 to the N RAID set. So it'll let you do any kind of RAID set, RAID 5 set from I think 3 plus 1 up to 31 plus 1, which must be really quite entertaining to see. But only if you do 4 plus 1 or 8 plus 1 or 16 plus 1, I guess, do you actually get the benefit of full re-modify write cycles not happening. Is it obvious whether your hardware has that restriction? No. Yes, there is a way to test. You build a RAID set of each size and you actually do a write to the raw block device in Linux and you time it with DD. If you are serious about tuning your RAID storage hardware, there will be quite a lot of this done. Oh, I should mention, of course, if you're doing tests like that, make sure that the LUN initialization is finished before you start. You'd be surprised how often that happens. You need to choose your RAID caching mode. It's a no-brainer that you want read caching and write caching. Well, that's not actually true, but in your case, most likely. There are actually reasons to occasionally want to turn these things on and off. You're extremely unlikely to hit those. Right? I'm sorry, what's that? Yes. Yes. We do ship units with write caching off. Blaming Junior. The defaults, as they come from the factory or kernel.org for a lot of these things, are not right. That's why we have these talks. So write cache mirroring is an interesting example. In general, it's slower but safer. So this is where you have two RAID controllers talking to the same disks. Hello, do we have a question back there? No, I'm just hallucinating, sorry. Okay, so you have two RAID controllers talking to the same disks, and your host, your NAS server, does a SCSI write to one of these RAID controllers, and then that RAID controller will not reply to the NAS server to say, yes, this stuff's on spinning Rust, until it's copied that data across to the other one. Obviously, there's a latency involved, but there are more subtle effects. So on some of the cheaper controllers, for example, that interconnect is shared between the front side bandwidth, the bandwidth to the disks as well. So you have, you can end up with, for example, getting a third of the throughput if you enable write cache mirroring. Well, it's not quite true. Two thirds. Again, you will need to experiment. All this stuff is horribly model dependent and hardware dependent. And, number two, tune the block layer. Now, there was a whole talk about this, and I wrote this before I saw that talk. So hopefully there's some fragments of reality left in it. We stick with the SLES default, which is complete fair queuing. Seems to work okay for us, but to be frank, we really haven't spent all that much time fussing with SGI. I'm really looking forward to what the Gelato guys are doing to actually get some good ideas about how to tune that. There is a long-known problem with CFQ having these little I/O context objects that are supposed to keep per process state and that interacting badly with the NFS server because the NFS server's thread model makes it really difficult to work that out. Despite that, it seems to work okay. But it's probably worth experimenting. If you're serious about tuning, it doesn't take long and it's not particularly dangerous to try a different scheduler. You're unlikely to get a lot of improvement. But if you have certain workloads and certain file systems, you can win a lot. Usually you want to increase the command tag queue depth, which tends to be default to one, which is of course the worst case where you have no parallelism whatsoever on the wire from your NAS server to your disk. You need a number that's larger than that. Four is a number I've just pulled out of thin air. There are limits to how high you can put this, and those limits are frequently not obvious, so your RAID controller may basically spit the dummy if you throw too many requests at once at it. Oh, yes? Yeah. Yes. Sometimes you may not be able to reach 8 if you have a lot of LUNs on a RAID controller that doesn't have a high limit. This is one of those things where you really need to experiment. The trouble is, you don't want to be trying too high because the failure mode is things like SCSI timeouts. And you really don't want that when some file systems are trying to do metadata layout. So this is one of those things where the optimal value is impossible to predict and tell you what it is right now. And I apologise for that. I wish the universe were better. Some more block layer stuff. You want max sectors KB, which is the largest size that your IOs going out the back end to the disk will be, assuming you have sufficiently laid out file systems and all the rest of it. You generally want to get that as large as possible, again, to amortise IO. And it's also rather important to make sure that's a multiple of RAID stripe width, for all the reasons that I've mentioned before. The Linux limit is actually in pages, not in K, so it depends on your page size. So on little toy servers, you end up with 512K. So that's your effective upper limit on your RAID stripe width, which is actually not all that large. That's usually at the low end of the cache, of the RAID stripe unit for serious RAID hardware. Finally, your max read ahead, which is a block device parameter, depending upon your block device driver, it may or may not be set sensibly. Modern versions of software will get this right. Historically, some versions haven't, including ones that we sell. And rather more detailingly, you need to make your changes persistent. We have some really neato stuff on our Linux add-ons CD that helps you to do that. But you can do interesting things like write UDEV rules, which I have no knowledge of and very happy of. Okay. Tune the file system. You need to know your file system. That means reading stuff and experiment. You need to tune for NFS workloads. That means not local workloads, and it means specifically not the application you're trying to run on a local disk, because NFS will perturb the I/O patterns that your local application does. So you need to be tuning for NFS workload. Again, this is really not obvious to some people. Some tunings, in fact, most of the ones I'm going to talk about now, are done at McAfee's time. So you actually need to run an experiment on real disks with not your real data. And you need to do that first if you're really serious about this. So one thing you should do is be careful when you're doing your partitioning or your volume manager arrangement, because if you have underlying RAID stripes, what you want to do is make sure that various file system structures are aligned to that. And one really great way of making sure that every file system structure is not aligned to the underlying RAID stripe width is to start your file system partway through a RAID stripe. So some volume managers, one we sell, for example, has a parameter that you can set up when you're setting up your volume element tree that will basically insert some empty space that is not useful except for padding, and that padding is very useful. I highly recommend using no AA time, or if you have a modern kernel, relay time on the server. People ask me about using no A time on the client. Whatever, it has no effect. A time is up to done on the server in NFS, so it has no effect at all. Removing A time entirely with no A time will improve performance, but it may confuse some apps, hence the existence of relay time. Again, you may need to experiment to see if anything bad goes wrong. Yes? Correct. No wait time in the client options has no effect. Okay, well, on the source I looked at, it had no effect. Come and talk to me later. We'll explore that. More file system stuff. Whole bunch of XFS specific things here, because that's what we ship on our boxes. XFS, again, this is version dependent, I should say. XFS needs some care and attention to get the best performance, because again, the defaults were historical compatibility. And in some versions, you needed to be a little bit careful specifying and reading back the units in the utilities that actually let you do these things, because, for example, it would report three numbers in one line, two of which were in kilobytes, one of which was in basic blocks, and not tell you which one is which, even in the documentation. That's a lot better in current versions of that code, but you may have an older one. You want to optimize your log.io. So there's a bunch of options you can do there, both Mount and McAfee's. A separate log device is a trick a lot of people use. There is this really neat feature called lazy super block counters that reduce the amount of time that XFS has to seek over and futz with the super block on disk. That's right. The modern XFS code has generally sensible defaults. A lot of people aren't on one. More XFS stuff. XFS has this idea where it knows something about underlying RAID stripes, and you tell it the stripe unit and stripe width, that it makes sure that IOs get aligned to those things, which is all very nice. I believe this is also the default, because McAfee actually tells it now, actually discovers that stuff properly in user space. Directory block size, bumping that up. Apparently this is really useful when you have workloads that do a lot of directory futzing with large directories, less IOs per directory entry, basically. Choosing the number of allocation groups. The default is basically a number pulled out of thin air. It can be dramatically the wrong number, too much, too little, not aligned to your RAIDs, all those kind of things. There's an entire black art there. If in doubt, futz or ask a real XFS person. It used to be the case that you had to change the I hash size to a very large prime number. I hate those kind of hash tables. To get inode heavy workloads to work. I believe it's some kind of tree now, so that's irrelevant. It's a bunch of radix trees now. Great, thanks. Tune the VM. One trick we use, and this is really kind of a dirty hack, is to tune the VM to push pages that are dirty in the server to the disk a little bit faster than the client decides to. So the trick here is to do bump down the write back centiseconds, so the VM checks this stuff more often, and to bump down the dirty background ratio, so it's more eager to start background write out. But your mileage may vary. And do not reduce the dirty ratio. You don't want NFSDs blocking to do foreground write out when they don't need to. Tune the PCI cards. God, I could go on for years about this stuff. A lot of this stuff looks weird. Like, oh, this one. Putting a card in some slot can actually slow down cards in other slots that are on different buses. Counterintuitive is the word I would say. Also, every single one of these things is real. There's a shipping box from SGI that does this. In fact, every single one of these things, I believe, is actually from boxes that SGI has shipped.
And most apply to not SGI boxes as well.
Oh, absolutely. I can report that number three definitely applies to non-SGI boxes too. Yes, there are a lot of weird things that can happen with PCI. So the upshot of that is you really need to know something about your hardware. You need to know where the right places to fit your PCI cards, and this means network cards, it means SCSI cards. And it means that, for example, sticking a card in an empty slot that's convenient is not always a very good idea because it may slow down other things you don't expect. Question? Indeed, I say something about that quite soon. Interrupt spraying is the spawn of the devil. Don't do it. There you go. I think that's actually documented somewhere in TechPubs, possibly in the user guide for one of them. There is a guide to sticking stuff in various slots, and will tell you if you stick this guy in here and have this slot populated at all, then this guy will be a times 4 bus, not a times 8 bus like you thought it was going to be. There's a lot of caveats, and it ain't just SGI hardware. So it's a lot of stuff that all hardware vendors kind of sweep under the rug. And it's also the reason why dedicated NFS servers can cost a lot of money. It's because you've had engineers like me sitting there and working all this shite out and making sure that you get something where you don't get weird PCI bottlenecks.
So sorry, this is a
PCI Express. By PCI, I mean PCI, PCI Express, PCIe, PCIe Next Gen, blah, 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 blah. Anything that starts has the word PCI anywhere in it. Any other bus you care to name that's same effects. It's, you know, you get weird things. Numer effects. Oh, you probably don't care. Fibre channel multipathing. Oh, this is a wonderful little gotcha. If you have actually multiple real paths of fibre channel between your NAS server and your actual disks, if you've got, you know, if you're building this kind of big HA setup and or you're just trying to get redundancy, or you just have too much money. Then you need to be careful that you don't end up doing what the volume manager or the multipathing software may decide to do for you, which is to run every single one of those I/O paths to disk down one HBA port. Yes, that is sometimes a good idea. However, if you do actually, if you are actually able to run those things in parallel, then you don't want that parallelism thrown away simply because a piece of software is too stupid to know how to do it. So if you're using our volume manager, then you need to futz with this file. If you're using our NAS software that ships on our NAS boxes, then it works that out for you. And God, that was a hard algorithm to write. So the end result is you need to know your hardware to get the best benefits out of everything. Tune the network. Basic parameters, just to make sure you're actually getting bits on the wire. Interrupt coalescing. NFS on a server is pretty much always bulk traffic for a server. Your default interrupt coalescing parameters on your server NICs are most likely set up as some kind of half-assed compromise between latency-bound traffic and bulk traffic. What we usually do is push those tunings in the direction of bulk. Yes, it does add latency on individual calls, but what we're trying to do here is deal with not just one client, but with your 100 or 2,000 or whatever clients that you have. If you do, and most people don't, if you do actually have latency-sensitive traffic you need to deal with, don't run it through the same NIC as you're running NFS. They'll both suck. Use a separate NIC. Tune that one separately. There's the ftool command. Some drivers don't support all those parameters. This is actually the numbers we use for Tigon 3 drivers. And this is widely supported on most modern cars. NIC and CPU binding. The goal you're trying to achieve with binding interrupts is to ensure that all the bits of RAM that the software needs to look at and futz with in order to actually service interrupts, and there's quite a lot of them in the interrupt code, in sometimes in the PCI code, in the device driver code, in the network stack, all that stuff is hot in this one CPU. That makes an enormous difference to your actual performance. So the procedure here is ifconfig will tell you the IRQ that the thing is using, and you use this magical incantation here to futz with /proc to actually bind that to a CPU. Choosing the CPU, of course, is sometimes interesting. The default algorithm would be something like choose one that's different for each card and close to it. And you may be running IRQ Balance D. IRQ Balance D doesn't know about your hardware. It's very dumb. It's entirely possible and in fact probable that you will do better than IRQ Balance D. Socket buffer sizes. Defaults, I have no idea why the defaults are that small. For anything 1 giga or above, you need much bigger numbers in order to actually get decent TCP flow over the net. Those are the numbers we use for 1 giga. We use larger numbers for 10 giga or for InfiniBand. The actual sys controls here have changed historically in the 2.6 series. So, actually, I'm not even sure these are the current ones. TCP segment offload. This is a feature that nice modern cards have and that, thanks to a whole lot of work by Dave Im, amongst other people, now actually works. And what it does is it allows a lot of the TCP grunt work to be done by the hardware instead of by the software. So essentially you shove a much larger amount of data that's going to go on the wire down to the card, and the card chops it up into TCP segments. Depending upon your card, it might be off by default. And there's the magic to enable it. And that should be available on most modern things. Again, it may not work spectacularly well on your card. We've seen a lot of very entertaining bugs with the firmware, just did bizarre things. Large receive offload is another thing you can use. haven't seen this on many cards, but it's the server-side equivalent of TSO. So you get a lot of segments on TCP segments on the wire being coalesced into one large, big lump that goes into RAM. Also very useful if you can get away with it. Receive-side scaling. This is what I've spent the last 5 or 6 weeks playing with. This is a feature you get on modern, very high throughput cards, 10 gig and InfiniBand. And what it does is it enables you to split up your interrupts, like the Neptune card that Dave M was talking about yesterday. It allows you to split up your interrupt load into multiple separate lots of interrupt that you can then distribute to different CPUs in a way where you maintain the mapping between particular TCP streams and the CPU. Enormously useful. However, it's a new thing, and you may need to fiddle. Hardware checksum offload. It might be off by default. I have no idea why you can... Apparently you can turn it off. I don't know why. It's just obviously a useful thing. If you're using IP over IB on InfiniBand, connected mode, if you have OFED 1.2 or later, connected mode can be a big win. When the next generation of InfiniBand cards is widely available, the Mellanox 4, you won't care again because it'll just accelerate everything to the point where it won't matter. But that's certainly something worth investigating right now if you're using InfiniBand. And, there's some stuff you can do with ARP that doesn't really matter. Bonding. Oh, you can have some fun with bonding. Bonding and UML. Gee, they hate each other. There's some interesting stuff here. I've discovered a lot of really interesting lies in switch documentation recently. If you're having bonding and you notice a significant drop in throughput between a bonded and a non-bonded configuration using the same NICs and the same clients, then there may be some opportunity for fussing. The transmit mode, so the bonding mode and the transmit hash policy are the options you want to fuss with there. Async. Here's an entertaining topic. The async export option, which is really, really quite different from the async from the sync mount option. Very different thing. On the client, you really want async. On the server, async will make things go faster for many, many workloads. However, it will actually put your data at risk. It makes the server lie about where the data is to the client. And there are situations where the client and the server, the wrong thing reboots at the wrong time, and bang, there are no copies of the data. It's worth doing it sometimes, but you really need to do the kind of risk-benefit analysis. So, no subtree check. Here's a no-brainer. Just disable subtree check. It's on by default. Well, it used to be on by default. I think it's in 1.08 of NFSU tools. I think it wasn't changed. There's really no benefit at all to subtree check if you actually export mount points. It has no actual effect except to waste CPU. There is a very good argument that Tron makes that the change on the wire that subtree check causes actually breaks NFS semantics. You're unlikely to notice, but there is an argument to be made. Use more server threads. How many? More! Just more! The default is way too low on pretty much your distro. 4 or 8 are numbers I've seen. And figuring out how many you need is really, really quite difficult. There are some stats you can look at in /proc. The stats are basically wrong and impossible to understand and don't actually help you predict anything anyway. It's also the case that there are server data structures which are sized at NFS server startup time by the number of threads that you have at that time. So changing the threads after you've started doesn't actually help you with those. And some of those, like the Redhead cache, are actually critical to performance. So just use a lot and put it in the sysconfig file. Just 128 is more than you need, but that doesn't matter. It's far better to have more than too few. I still couldn't think of 10. And I still haven't. So there we go. I actually have, what, 5 minutes nearly? 3 minutes. Does anybody have a question that I can use to guide us through the remainder of the bonus stuff? Yes. Recommendations for application developers. Number one, do not use ODirect. Number two, use large IOs. Number three, never use OSync. Number four, well, actually, just don't try to be clever, actually. Use large buffers, do large IOs, let the buffers, just use buffered IO and let all the software that's kind of there to tune it make its own decisions. If you use direct, I actually posted an update to the Open Man page that for some reason Michael Kiriska has been ignoring, that tells you not to use ODirect. We have this culture inside with the applications people in SGI that comes down to, ooh, ODirect is good because you can bypass things. Bypass must be faster. Well, no. ODirect does things that make things faster sometimes locally and never remotely. If I could sum it up in one, don't try to be too clever. And if I got two, make your behavior optional or tunable. Any others?
Cool. You said that async on the client server is coming a little bit. Can you elaborate on
that? Yes, I can elaborate on async versus sync. Somewhere, here we go. Sync v sync. So, two options, same name, different behavior. They do different things and they do not have to be consistent. I have had people come to me and explain to me how it's really important to get them two pointing in the same direction. This couldn't be further from the truth. The fundamental rule here is if they're both sync, your performance will suck. What they do is the client mount option is a generic Linux mount option, and it results in the client serializing IOs and writes in particular end up waiting until the data is on stable storage on the server. So you do a write, you wait 4 milliseconds or whatever. You do a write, you wait 4 milliseconds. Without sync, you do 4 writes, they go into RAM. You do 4 writes, they go into RAM. You do 4 writes, they go into RAM. So, you know, it could be 100 to 1,000 times slower. So on the client, you definitely want the async. Sync on the server is very different. So sync, which is the default in some versions of NFSU tools, sync makes the server obey the RFC. Async makes it lie, so hence the data loss probability. But what it means is that when the client tells the server, hey, don't return to me, don't tell me you're done until this data is on spinning Rust, the server says, yep, it's on spinning Rust, fingers crossed. And yes, it does make things faster. So if you want best speed, you want async on both. The default or sensible options is async on the client, sync on the server. If you have a RAID unit that's battery backed, is async safe? No. It's because the data is sitting in the server's RAM, not sent to the RAID yet. And the server crashes, and the client has already marked that data as not dirty and possibly purged it under memory pressure. So that doesn't help. RAID battery backed RAM does not make async any safer. Yep. Yes. Good point. So RAID hardware caching can iron out a lot of the slowness due to the sync option. That's why if you have a decent RAID backend, it is worth using sync. Are we done?
Unfortunately, we have sync here and now. Too much information. We all learned a lot, and we appreciate learning a lot, because you never know when you'll use it.